This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. What's the real story on crime? Former crime reporter David Krychek says we don't have a grasp on what the nation's real crime problems are because we've gotten sidetracked by the media. We've been tabloidized. In Krychek's words, we know everything about Amy Fisher, but next to nothing about the development of our national criminal justice policies. And not to lay all the blame on the media, Krychek has a few darts to toss in the direction of our political leaders. David Krychek is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. As we talk, you can join the conversation. Your questions and comments are welcome. Here are the phone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. David Krychek was a reporter for The Daily News in New York for 5 years. He now teaches at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He is the author of Scooped, Media Misreal Story on Crime While Chasing Sex, Sleaze, and Celebrities. Again, our phone number is toll-free, 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. David Krychek, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Happy to be here.
Would you share with our listeners the story you tell in Scooped about covering the Mike Tyson-Robin Givens story?
Yeah, I was minding my own business, I guess, covering my beat at the Daily News in New York City, which, for the edification of your listeners, is a tabloid, but I think a good tabloid, a decent tabloid that likes to have fun with the news but understands the difference between frivolity and fun. I was working at police headquarters at the Daily News. I was in charge of covering crime for the newspaper, working out of police headquarters down at the Manhattan side of the Brooklyn Bridge, staff of five or six. Get a call one day from my boss saying, come on uptown to East 42nd Street, the main office. We've got a project we want you to be involved in. And I went up dutifully, gathered in a room with six or seven other individuals, including notably Jack Newfield, who was, he's one of America's preeminent investigative reporters for a long time, was at the Village Voice, and had come over to the Daily News about a year before. The editors of the paper assembled a team of what they thought were some of their best people to investigate a very pressing matter, the breakup of the marriage of Mike Tyson and the actress Robin Givens, Mike Tyson being the heavyweight boxer, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of sat there scratching my head saying, why am I being invited to this particular party? But I was invited nonetheless. With the help of Jack Newfield's sources, I tracked down Robin Givens' father. His name was Reuben, up in the Bronx. Interviewed him one morning, late one morning, in September, I believe it was, about 10 years ago, and woke him up at 11 a.m. And it was clear that her father was not in good condition, that he'd had problems with addictions and so forth. And he went to, he told me basically that he had never met Tyson. He spoke only rarely with his daughter. His daughter was raised by his ex-wife. He spoke with some obvious bitterness about his lack of contact in her life now that she was, at that time, a television star and so forth. And I took notes and thanked him for his time. And as I was leaving, he asked me to pay him for the time we'd spent together. And I said, well, that's, sir, a violation of journalism ethics. I couldn't do such a thing. And he kind of thought for a second and said, well, can you loan me $5 for cigarettes then? I didn't give him the money. I went back to the newsroom. I typed up my notes. I informed my bosses that the interview didn't lead to any revelations, but that it might be a two or three, four paragraphs in some other story. A couple days later, I get a call at home at midnight waking me up from the editor who's in charge of the Team Tyson, as I was calling it, said, I'm looking at a newspaper that has a story about Reuben Givens. It says that he talks with his daughter all the time, that he met Tyson, that he wasn't impressed by Tyson, he told his daughter to dump him, etc., etc., and just went on and on and on about the details that this fellow had given some other reporter. And I said, that's impossible. I looked him in the eye. I know he was telling me the truth. I said, who in the world has this story? And he said, the Inquirer. And as I sat there on the edge of my bed at midnight, or 10 after midnight on this particular night, I thought, why would the Philadelphia Inquirer get involved in chasing this story that was quite a New York story? And I said, the Philadelphia Inquirer? And he said, no, the National Inquirer. And I said, Arthur, I can't believe you're asking me to, you're questioning the veracity of my reporting against a tabloid that reports on two-headed Martians and so forth. Celeste, eventually, the Inquirer version of Reuben Givens' comments won out, because mine didn't make the newspaper. We didn't chase the story per se at that time. We didn't chase the National Enquirer story per se, but my comments that I elicited from Reuben Givens didn't go in the newspaper either. So, you know, looking at it one way, you could say that the National Enquirer version won out. Now, I say in the book that today, in 1998, we say, well, so what, Krychek? The National Enquirer, everybody does that. But this was 10, 11 years ago, and everyone wasn't doing it at the time. But my editor, it turns out, was being quite prescient, because he did something that soon everyone would be doing, chasing tabloids.
Yeah. You also say in your account of that experience that really made you mad, but you didn't take it any further. You didn't talk it out with the editor.
It's kind of the nature of journalism that, you know, I guess I'm smart enough. I hope that I'm the type of person who's smart enough to lay aside that angry memo today and look at it again tomorrow and see if I really want to send it. Well, that's sort of the way that I've tried to function. As a daily reporter, you get in a fight today, and then you go home mad, and you have a drink or whatever you need to do to salve your wounds. Then you come back the next morning, and you're off on another chase. You know, you're off on tomorrow's story. So you have to say, do I want to take up my time and energy picking a fight over yesterday? And I acknowledge that I was wrong. I think that tabloidization happened because too many journalists like me failed to pick those fights. I know a lot of reporters who stood outside houses on stakeouts, or stood outside venues, you know, hotels, waiting for a celebrity to come out because they were involved in the scandal of the moment, sort of looking at one another, talking with one another, saying, why are we here? What are we doing here? This isn't journalism. This isn't why we went to journalism school. This isn't what we got into the profession for. Collectively, though, we assented. We stood there and waited to take the celebrity pictures or to shout the questions, hey, Joey, do you still love her?
Mm. Talk with us about the culture of journalism, the pack, and, you know, the concern, as was on the part of your editor all those years ago, of being scooped by the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
How all these things come together and keep us, you know, on this treadmill.
Yeah. Competition really is the crank that turns the wheel. Competition is the reason that the New York Times covered O.J. The way it did. Competition is the reason that newspapers across America covered the Joey Buttafuoco, Amy Fisher story as though it were the most pressing news of the day. I say in the book that the peer culture in journalism is as intense as that at any junior high school. That we look to one another, both colleagues and peers, to decide how we're going to do something, and in fact, what we're going to do, what we're going to cover. I think it's clear to me that tabloidization began to happen in 1986 when the first tabloid television program went on the air. It was called The Current Affair. Most of your listeners probably remember it. Had the very unique slogan with a big ka-chung, a triangular slogan that ka-chunged onto the screen, quite striking. It was really a brilliant stroke by Rupert Murdoch, who at the time was trying to get some attention for his nation network, Fox. A Current Affair went on the air, and it started covering stories that were very tabloid in nature. Basically, A Current Affair was the prototype tabloid television program in America. It was was a video version of one of the racier, saucy London tabloids. And it covered those same sorts of stories. You know, naughty girls in pink lace knickers. That's the ultimate British Fleet Street tabloid story. Adulterous ministers, pedophilic priests, and weird and odd and peculiar things. Things that are you might see in a side in a carnival sideshow that sort of attracts your attention. Those programs attract viewers. You know, there's an interest, there's an abiding interest for stories about sex and sleaze and weirdness in general. The National Enquirer has always covered those sorts of stories, but the National Enquirer sells about 1 million copies a week. A Current Affair at its peak was drawing 27 million viewers per day, or extrapolated over a 5 or 6 day broadcast week, we're talking about 150 million viewers. You know, virtually half the population of America. These stories sort of leach then into the culture, and you know, journalists and editors and producers start hearing that people across America are covering are talking about, you know, the Florida Nympho case. You know, this Picayune prostitution arrests in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, that somehow suddenly became part of the national media scene because it was appearing on A Current Affair. And the editors say, well, gee, let's call the wire services and make sure that the AP is moving stories that we can publish about the Florida Nympho case and so on and so forth. And that's sort of how it happens. It's on A Current Affair, and A Current Affair is kind of like journalism, and therefore, and they're doing stories people are talking about, so therefore shouldn't we be writing stories about the same thing? It's sort of like in junior high school where one kid shows up one day with a plaid shirt, and a month later, everybody in the school is wearing plaid shirts.
And also within the newsroom there is a culture among the reporters. You came from Nebraska, and you went through some hazing so that you would become part of the fraternity.
That's right, yeah. Right.
That's at work too, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, pressure from one's own colleagues to do things a certain way. When you're out on a, you know, let's say that in a big city like New York where there were 4 or 5 daily newspapers, and you're all standing out on the same stakeout, New York Times, Newsday, the New York Post, you know, the Staten Island Advance, and the Daily News. You know, people don't wear placards that say, I'm from the Times, therefore I do things a certain way, or I'm from the Post, and therefore I do things a certain way. It's sort of, you know, this phrase, lowest common denominator, takes over. And that same sort of culture is present in one's newsroom, in one's own newsroom, where there's a reporter or two who are willing to do certain things, and, you know, they get the attention, they get the bylines, they get the raises, and all of a sudden everyone else in the newsroom says, hey, wait a minute, shouldn't I be doing that too? I worked, as you said, in Nebraska, in Omaha. I also worked in Iowa. And I said, you know, in the big cities, in a place like the Daily News, you might well get a bonus for doing something that might have gotten you fired in Nebraska, you know, climbing a fence to trespass or something like that.
Cases like the one involving Joey Buttafuoco and Amy Fisher, or the case of Heidi Fleiss is another one. Do they deserve to be covered in the pages of the mainstream press?
No. Joey Buttafuoco case was a really rather incidental case of felonious assault. It was flopped onto the national news agenda because it involved sex, because it involved a nubile Long Island teenager, and you know. I don't know if there's the old curmudgeon editor still around, because a lot of the decision makers are, as likely as not, at New York newspapers to be women. But you know, I guess I had this image that, you know, I was getting some charge out of some old curmudgeon male editor that, you know, to put this stuff in his newspaper. But how can you make a case that Heidi Fleiss deserved to be covered? Basically, what the question here is. Is it news that people in Los Angeles are paying to have sex with someone else? No, I don't think that's news. Case after case after case after over the past 12 or 13 years that we've seen flopped onto the national news agenda for no particular reason, all have that hook, all have some sex angle, whether it was the William Kennedy Smith scandal in Florida, a little bit easier to make a case that that deserved coverage, Joey Buttafuoco, Amy Fisher, Michael Jackson, the allegations against him, the Florida Nympho case that I mentioned earlier, that was really just a picayune prostitution case that deserved probably agate coverage at the back of the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel. All of a sudden, these are stories that we can have conversations with friends all over the world, not just North America. I could have a conversation with a friend in Toronto, London, Paris, and San Diego about the Joey Buttafuoco case. And why is that?
It seems to me that the way we've come to cover crime and the way we've, you know, the way we're deciding this is a story, this isn't a story, is affecting the way other beats are being covered. The Monica Lewinsky story, we have a possible crime, but it's you know, we're having sort of crime coverage creep into political coverage, or maybe it's not even creeping. Maybe it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
And if we go back before Monica Lewinsky, Jennifer Flowers, also this kind of coverage, I think, came to happen in the Vincent Foster story.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's a very important point to make that, once again, the hook, more often than not, is sex. The Dick Morris prostitution scandal, Dick Morris being the former advisor to President Clinton, you know, it unveiled political hypocrisy somehow that he was sucking a hooker's toes when he wasn't playing advisor to the president. And yet, so you say, well, that's a legitimate story. And yet, it happened to involve sex. Jennifer Flowers called into question the character of the guy that wanted to be president of the United States. And yet, it involves sex. You know, all the way down the line, Jim Baker, the TV preacher, and Jessica Hahn, his alleged, I don't know, paramour or the woman that he had sex with, I guess, you know, involved financial deceit and so forth in the religion racket, and yet it also happened to involve sex. The Bobbitts, you know, somehow involved sex in a sort of a distorted way. And that same, you're right, that same feeling is creeping into, you know, the political beat. The Monica Lewinsky case and the coverage is, you know, very much part and parcel of the criticisms that I make about the crime beat.
Yeah. David Krycek is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Scooped, Media Miss Real Story on Crime While Chasing Sex, Sleaze, and Celebrities. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Your calls are welcome this afternoon. You can join us with your questions and comments. Toll free 1-800-222-9455. Or if you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, call us at 333-9455. Our first caller this afternoon is on line 4 in Eureka. Hello.
Hi. May I have just a comment, comment, and then just get your guest reaction to something, please?
Sure.
I was reminded of one of Jay Leno's more incisive comments when he said, I think the line was, there was a mass firing at the National Enquirer because a truthful item actually got into the newspaper. My comment is, I live in a small rural county, and some examples have been exactly as you said about news. The Bloomington Pantograph has been trumpeting a couple strip clubs in a little town called Kappa, 10 miles north. That seems to be news. But and to get more specific, we had in this county a state's attorney that was an alcoholic who actually turned up at work drunk, according to one newspaper account, but the media didn't seem to be too interested in it. There was a murder case that one of the columnists in the local paper got interested in, which a young woman, and again, you probably never heard of this town, there are small towns near here, in Menomora, her head was hammered against the back of a bar, and then her body was dumped out halfway between Washington and Menomora. That's a town about 8 miles west. And the point of this was Rick Baker, who was the columnist of the original Star, was that the state's attorney had failed to find the witnesses, and he had found them in 10 minutes, and he had no reaction. But this is the kind of thing. I think media can be helpful, but I think had they pursued this, this man may have been driven from office. But he came into office at the time that then-Governor Edgar was the state's attorney and was building his reputation on DUI laws. But I think it's a case where media could have been very careful, very helpful in an investigation, but they just seemed to let it drop there.
Right. I guess it's interesting that you use a homicide case as an example. One of the problems that I have with the way crime is covered, the way that the crime beat is covered, is that there's too much attention to homicide cases typically, that homicide cases often are the aberrations, yet they're a problem in crime journalism, as it is on many beats, that often there's a coziness between the authorities and the reporters and editors and so forth, that they're reticent often to aggressively pursue allegations like that.
The crime beat is often the first beat that a young reporter gets. Does inexperience contribute to the poor quality?
Tough decisions that the authorities have to make about where to employ their resources and how to use their personnel and so forth. And I'm quite typical, unfortunately. Now, that was a fairly small city, Council Bluffs, but I've talked to reporters in places like Philadelphia where the training amounts to the same thing. You basically get a list of phone numbers, and some editor says, here, call these phone numbers and ask what's happening today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But crime news makes up so much of the content of newspapers and television and radio broadcasts.
Yeah, typically one-third of the content of your average daily newspaper is crime and court news related, and as much as half of the typical television newscast, and I think your listeners know that percentage can go much higher. You know, the Fox affiliate in Chicago, for example, is some days will be 80% crime. It's just one crime story after another, one crime and court story after another. And no anchor ever stops to say, oh, by the way, even though we're presenting crime as being the Armageddon the moment, no one ever says, oh, by the way, crime is down approximately 30% in America over the past 5 years. That's one of the problems, the lack of context. We get so carried away with the anecdotes, with the aberrational anecdotes often, we don't give our listeners, our readers, and our viewers the context of what the true problem is or the scope of the problem.
Mm. Now, you're at Columbia now. Are you teaching crime reporting?
Yeah, I'm actually on leave now. I'm writing another book, but my seminar at the school that I most recently taught was criminal justice reporting. It was sort of a soup-to-nuts course in crime reporting, courts reporting, prisons, prison reporting, crime policy reporting, and so forth.
Hmm.
I'm also involved, Celeste, in sort of to give you some indication of the status of crime reporting in most newsrooms. Many types of reporting are done better today than ever before. I think you could very easily make the argument that science reporting is better than ever. It gets more attention, certainly. Political reporting is more savvy than it used to be, and it's probably more honest when you think back to the days when, you know, the American public didn't know that FDR spent his time in a wheelchair and no one reported about the sexual dalliances of President Kennedy and so forth. Political reporting is certainly more prevalent, if nothing else. You could make the case that education reporting is as good as it's ever been in America.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can also very easily make the case that finance and economic reporting are better than ever. And yet crime reporting basically is done the same way that it's always been done since the genre of newspapers were created in the English language, I don't know, a couple hundred years ago. And while most types of specialty, virtually every type of specialty in the world of journalism has always had a national professional association, crime reporting has not. You know, there's an Association of Women Baseball Writers of America. There's a science association. There's an Environmental Reporting Association, and so on and so forth. I'm involved with a group of journalists who consider themselves criminal justice specialists, long-term specialists, in creating the first National Association of Crime Reporters. It's called Criminal Justice Journalists, holding our second annual meeting this fall in Washington.
Mm, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Because crime stories are very compelling. They're very much about human nature. And also, you know, there's more, though, than just reporting who did what or who's charged with what. The judiciary is the third branch of government, and it doesn't get the kind of coverage it deserves.
Right. And there are journalists out there doing fine work in,
right,
in this realm, but, you know, it's the good journalism amounts to a dinghy bobbing in this roiling sea of sensationalism. You know, you turn on the TV this weekend, you get nothing but Monica, you know, the specialty channel. People say, well, gosh, there are so many channels now. Just think of all the opportunities for fine programming. And if I went and turned on my television right now to the Fox Network, CNBC, and MSNBC, and so on and so on, CNN, you know, it's going to be nothing but Monica Lewinsky. It's a tremendous problem trying to get the good journalism, you know, out there. This organization that I'm involved in is some small way helping to do that by attempting to professionalize the beat.
Mm-hmm. Does the public bear any responsibility for the news it gets?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. There are two ways to look at this. Number one, that we feed them what they demand. We give them what they demand. The second is that they've got to eat what we feed them. So it's very much a two-way street, and we both have to accept responsibility. I think, first of all, an acknowledgement by the public that there are going to be sexy stories and there are going to be horrendous stories that happen in a country of 65-70 million people on a daily basis. And, you know, I'm not sure that I need to know about a horrendous murder in a small town in Utah or, you know, in Washington State or whatever. There's been a morose fascination with death forever, going back to before parchment was the medium of choice for transmission of news. Traveling balladeers would go from village to village and give tales of adultery and war and death and destruction from, you know, the neighboring villages back in the Middle Ages. And it's the same sort of thing today. So I worked out a couple of high-minded theories in my book about, why we're so fascinated. I think part of it is sort of like the elephants that sniff obsessively at the bones of a fallen member of their species. I don't know if you've seen that, but elephants will kick and turn over the bones and throw them up in the air and so forth. Sort of, I always think that they're looking for clues as to how they can keep the same fate from befalling them.
Mm.
We also, I think, are fascinated by stories of disaster in other places because it somehow makes us feel safer in our homes, in our environment. Sociologists call this the grass is browner theory, that we like the grass to be browner on the other side of the fence, and the browner the better. So I was running some of these theories by some reporter friends of mine as I was writing this book, and I was speaking with a fellow in Cleveland, a courts reporter in Cleveland named Mark Rollenhagen, and I described the elephants and I described the grass is browner theory, and I said, Mark, why do you think crime stories are so popular? And he thought for a second and he said, because people like to read them. And yes, he's absolutely right. I think that it's important, Celeste, that you know, your listeners understand. I'm certain most will, but some may not, that you have to understand that you can't go around complaining about what's on TV about Monica Lewinsky and O.J. Simpson and the Florida Nympho type cases and turn to that page first, or, you know, turn to that newscast first.
Let's take another call. Our next caller is on line 4 in Chicago.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I never fail to recommend Lincoln Steffens' autobiography when I get a chance. His interest was originally in ethics and morality and what effect that has on crime and that sort of thing. It developed into that, and his first job was as a police reporter, a cop reporter in central headquarters in New York City. And so not too different from what it is these days, I guess.
You're absolutely right, and Lincoln Steffens, one of the chapters in his wonderful book, The Autobiography of Lincoln Steffens, is entitled I Make a Crime Wave.
Right, yeah.
And it's about precisely what we're talking about. In fact, I quote that in my book, that this is not a new concept, that building false trends out of an anecdotal crime. Lincoln Steffens nailed it approximately 100 years ago.
This book was written in 31, so he died a year or two afterwards, I guess. But
yeah, and he was a crime reporter down at police headquarters in Manhattan during, I believe, the 1880s, 1890s.
Right, yeah, that's when he started.
Yeah, yeah.
Very
good tip.
What I've been wondering, and I'm pretty well convinced, is that there's malice aforethought in the printing of so much crime news in the newspapers and over TV, I guess, also. And the malice aforethought being that if you cover this and you don't have to cover what's really necessary and the important political and economic news. I believe it's the business interests of the newspapers tied in with the editorial department and tied in with business all over, which doesn't want economics really covered and business covered and so on.
Again, I think you make a very good point, sir. I guess I would add that I'm not sure that there's some conspiracy of editors who say, let's not cover that, let's cover this. I think it's more of young editors, young producers coming into work in the morning and saying, oh boy, all that blank space to fill, all that dead air to fill. We better get a crew over to that fire. Let's talk to Krycek over at police headquarters and find out what crimes are going on today. It often is a case of choosing, a case of the difference between what's interesting and easy. I'm sorry, what's interesting, what's easy, and what's important. We almost always will grab as the first assignments what comes easily to the assignment editor. What's interesting will come second. What's important often comes third. And I think the enlightened point of view in the world of journalism today is that it's more challenging, but it's vital that what we do is make what's important interesting.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Maybe we could talk about a particular story and its result in terms of some public policy decisions, the kidnapping and murder of Polly Klass. It resulted in what's known as Polly's Law, passage of three strikes and you're out legislation. You want to talk with us about your thoughts on how the story was covered?
Yeah, I think it was covered over the top. You know, this was a horrible crime. I guess the problem is that people in my position who criticize coverage of something like that, that the natural reaction for people to say is, you know, they use the illogical argument of, well, what are you saying, that you wouldn't cover it? No, well, that's not what I would say at all. But I can give you lots of detailed examples of how it was covered that was simply over the top. NBC News that week did a package of stories several nights on the Polly Klass case, including the sort of requisite piece of how you can stop this from happening to you. All the national news mags did cover stories in the weeks after the Polly Klass murder that basically had the theme of our children are no longer safe in their own homes. Even magazines like Business Week did a cover story that played off the Polly Klass case with the economics of crime, and the front cover had bullet holes in it with blood leaching out of each of these red bullet holes. The Polly Klass murder was a horrible tragedy for that family. It may have been a case where the system failed because the killer was a parolee.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that collectively we have to accede to the fact that we can't lock everyone up forever, that sooner or later people are going to get out of prison, and sooner or later one of those people is going to commit another crime. That's just a fact that we as a nation need to face up to. It's a statistical certainty that recidivism will happen. The problem with polyclas is that crime was going down at that time in America. It was something like the third or fourth quarter in a row where finally crime had started to ebb. And we worked ourselves up into a frenzy of sorts, a crime frenzy of sorts, believing that people were going to come in, nefarious individuals were going to break into our homes and steal our children, when really that's irrational and illogical. Now, what typically happens, and what happened in that case, is legislators sort of took the opportunity, seized the opportunity. Joe Biden, the Delaware senator, says no one ever loses a vote by saying he's going to be tough on crime. Three strikes legislation had kind of been languishing in the California legislature. It had been a proposal for a number of years that basically if you screw up three times, you're going to prison for life. And policy experts and criminologists had convinced the legislators that it probably wasn't cost-effective, that it probably wasn't smart law, smart policy. But the publicity over the polyclas case sort of gave a springboard to three strikes. In fact, initially, polyclas's father was opposed to the three strikes legislation. He changed his mind halfway through the debate. But I think, as we all know, three strikes not only swept California, it swept most state houses in America, and as often happens, worked its way to the Capitol in Washington. And our prisons are now full of people. We have three to four times as many people in jail now as we did in 1980, and I think we have to ask ourselves if we feel safer as a result of it.
In Scoop, you mentioned that crime has its special interests, which is something worth thinking about, I think. Talk with us about who they are and what role they play.
Right. That was one of the issues, your caller from Chicago, that I think we have to be careful of saying that, business leaders have some sort of collusion with newspapers. It does not behoove a city to have itself presented as being full of crime. I think New York's a good example of that with a crack plague. New York was really on the skids for a number of years as a result of its reputation as sort of the crack headquarters of America. Police departments don't necessarily want to portray cities as being crime-free. No police chief will ever say, okay, crime's down, we don't need this many cops anymore. Let's cut the number of cops by 10% because crime dropped 10% last year. You won't hear cops saying that sort of thing. Police unions have a fiscal, a financial, and economic interest in crime, because when crime is up, more cops are going to be hired. When more cops are hired, there are more members of the union. When there are more members of the union, your political clout is increased. There's a huge prison industry, private prison industry, that's developed in America, really just in the past 8 years or so. Privatization of prisons, where companies are profiting from all these people that are being sent to prison. Companies like the club, this device that allegedly keeps your car from being stolen, it behooves those companies to portray crime as being up in America. You see the advertisements on television all the time. Protect yourself. Your car could be stolen any minute. I saw a classified ad in a local newspaper that said, big letters and exclamation points, crime is up, so buy pepper spray. Protect yourself. Those sorts of companies also have an economic interest in high crime. Crime is an industry. We should all understand that. Crime is an industry, not just for the criminals.
So what are the chances of seeing some improvement in the way stories on crime and punishment are reported?
Well, she says with a heavy sigh. I I guess I can't say that I'm optimistic, but I'm not pessimistic either. What I do think is that the change will come from journalism itself. That I think that there is a little bit of a movement in newsrooms where certain editors, certain reporters are saying, we're not doing it, we're not doing that story anymore, we're not doing it that way anymore. Lots of my colleagues in this criminal justice journalist group have taken stands at their newspapers when they've saw witnessed poor crime reporting. They encourage editors to do more pieces on crime policy rather than just the crime of the day or the trial of the week. I was quite encouraged, and then Monica Lewinsky happened, and we've returned full tilt to a sleazy story. After OJ, I think there was so much hand-wringing that many of us in the business thought that the excess was inherently unsustainable, that something had to happen. Now I'm not so sure. I'm hopeful, but I'm not certain.
On the politics beat, as we're headed into an election here and just, I don't know, not very many weeks away at all, as reporters quiz politicians and candidates on crime and crime policy, what kind of questions would you hope they'd ask?
I would ask them what they mean by tough on crime, because certainly they're going to say, I'm going to be tougher on crime than the person before me or my opponent. I would pin them down. What do you mean? And if you want more people in prison, how are you going to pay for it? How are you going to come up with the prison cells? What's your long-range plan for warehousing prisoners? It costs us a certain amount per year in a heavily populated state like Illinois. The figure is quite high, something along the lines of $40,000 a year to keep a person in jail in prison for 1 year. How do you plan to sustain that rate of spending? If your platform, if the primary plank in your platform is to be tough on crime, I want details.
Yeah. Join us. We'll have film at 11.
Yeah. That's the next trend, Celeste. Paul Kleit from Rocky Mountain Media Watch said that, I said, Paul, how much worse can it get? He's a media critic in Denver. How much worse can it get? Where can we go from where we've gone already? And he said, topless anchors. And I was doing a radio interview, and I suggested that maybe topless anchors were next, and the anchor said, oh, Dave, we're already topless here on the radio show.
Oh, boy. Well, we'll button up here quickly.
Yeah.
We're all ashamed now and red-faced.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure, Celeste.
David Krycek. Look for his book, Scooped, Media Miss Real Story on Crime While Chasing Sex, Sleaze, and Celebrities. It's published by Columbia. By the way, David's name is spelled K-R-A-J-I-C-E-K, pronounced Krycek.